Listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 329. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with researcher Alex Nelson, who's based in London, Ontario, Canada, at Western University. And I spoke to Alex, I think, about a very important topic in regards to understanding the nature of the housing crisis today in Canada. Often, mainstream media narratives really paint either super individualized portraits of, you know, at times people experiencing injustice in relation to housing precarity, but also that type of reporting, I think, removes an understanding of the sort of connections and common points of experience between the ways that housing precarity is tied to systemic issues like the financialization of housing. Also, this was a chance to speak with somebody who's really invested in pushing for housing advocacy and research work that is directly tied to those who have experienced housing precarity themselves. I just wanted to share this conversation. It's coming out of work that I've been doing here on the program, but also more broadly to document and lift up voices involved in housing justice work. You can learn more about that at housingjustice.now. But here is my conversation with researcher Alex Nelson on the collective nature of housing crisis points in Canada today on this week's edition of Free City Radio. There's an acknowledgement in Canada of there being a profound housing crisis. This is spoken about openly across the political spectrum. And that point of acknowledgement is relatively new. The sort of point of distance between a lot of the ways that this crisis is being addressed in terms of political language and, you know, sort of thinking about or thinking through alternatives to this very intense reality that many people are experiencing in relation to the housing crisis is sort of how do you involve people who are facing it? You know, and Alex, your research kind of looks at this question. It seems that often when there's quote unquote solutions proposed, that there's not a lot of process that actually involves communities that are experiencing housing precarity or, you know, facing being without a home. So maybe we could start with an introduction, but also some of your reflections on from your vantage point as a researcher at Western University, how some of the work that you've done with community organizations sort of speak to that importance of a more ground-up approach that centers the experience of people who are dealing with these questions directly.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to start by saying, locating myself as a person with lived experience of homelessness, it's really important to me to explain that my own firsthand experiences shape the way that I think about why lived experience is so important, especially because in my own history and story and way of experiencing the housing system, there have been these points of disconnection between what I knew to be true and saw firsthand and the kind of dominant stories that are told about what homelessness is, how it happens, what it looks like, what it feels like. And so I always knew that there was something that I wanted to do with those stories and also that kind of knowledge from the ground up. And so that's really important to me to kind of name from the beginning, because it's other people who have those direct experiences who I'm in community with, who have helped me gain the knowledge that I have. And so that kind of lineage of knowledge sharing is so vital in addressing the housing crisis and to say, you know, there's profound knowledge about some of these disconnects that exist within communities that are facing these issues firsthand. And the answers already exist. I think knowing that in communities across the country, there is such a profound need around housing, and the solutions that are being proposed and being forwarded really don't always fundamentally address some of the underlying issues that lead to homelessness in the first place. Issues like colonization, issues like white supremacy, homophobia, transphobia, things that uproot people from their homes and cause fractures and magnify fractures in society. And I think the solutions that we need to put forward need to grapple with these things directly.
Thanks for sharing that, Alex, and sort of giving a sense of where you're coming from. Maybe it would be interesting first to start by any thoughts you have about the way that the current government in Canada is addressing this question, because there is a lot of talk about the housing crisis and the need to build homes, etc., and sort of offering a sort of deeper sense of some of the limitations of the policy that exists, and maybe just also highlight some examples of like organizations or processes that you've been connected to that you feel would be important to listen to in a context like the one that we're in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I've seen, and I'm not sure there are necessarily structures in place to address directly, is the financialization of housing. In Canada, through the National Housing Strategy Act of 2019, there were human rights mechanisms that were introduced to help alleviate homelessness and address housing rights issues across the country. The first review panel launched in connection with the National Housing Strategy Act was addressing this issue of the financialization of housing, which is essentially, you know, housing being primarily seen as a tool to generate profit and not as a human right. And those ideas of what housing is and what it should be are often in conflict. And so when I hear things like, you know, we need to focus on supply, we need to focus on building homes, that doesn't necessarily mean that people will be able to have the resources to afford those homes. And often, even if homes exist, people are not able to access them with the resources that they have. I think that these deep issues of unaffordability aren't really meaning that homelessness is being alleviated. And I know that not being able to afford housing is really pressing concern for people living in Canada, some communities being impacted more directly and more deeply than others. There was a rental market report that came out within the last few years that showed that in some communities like Toronto, Victoria, several others, the availability of housing that's affordable to the lowest income earners in Canada is statistically zero, which means that even if housing's created, often it's going to be housing that meets the needs of people who already have those resources to afford it. And so people are kind of pushed out the bottom of the market in a way that makes issues around housing so much deeper and so much worse. And so there are organizations working at a national level to help address some of these issues and are helping to kind of shed light on some of the stories that are undertold. One of the issues that I also work around is housing rights for 2SLGBTQ plus people and gender diverse people specifically. So transgender, non-binary, two-spirit folks. Because the housing system is also set up in a way that often excludes or reinforces discrimination or doesn't protect or affirm people who are not cisgender. And that kind of dovetails with some of these anti-trans sentiments that are becoming increasingly more prevalent in this country. One organization that I've worked with over the last several years working on this issue is the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network. They do a lot of advocacy around gender-based responses to the housing crisis and do a lot of research that I think is shifting narratives around housing and homelessness and allowing different possibilities for stories to be told. Research that I supported with the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network a few years ago, for example, it was research that involved surveys of over 500 women, girls, and gender diverse people, showed that for the majority of respondents, people's most recent experience of homelessness was due to the breakup of a romantic relationship. That is not part of the story that gets told around homelessness in Canada. And I think that when we're thinking about, you know, how do we address housing need, housing precarity, homelessness amongst different communities, different types of people, we need to be thinking outside of, you know, the box that is the standard, the norm, because so many people are becoming homeless for reasons that are not addressed effectively by policy.
So you touched on a number of points there, Alex. Thank you. I wanted to go back to a key issue that you addressed, which is the financialization of housing and sort of the, you know, there's a lot of layers to that, and you mentioned earlier the importance of understanding, you know, sort of the connections between the housing crisis and continued patterns of colonization, and sort of how, like, quote unquote, home ownership enforces this conception of ownership over territory, which, on its sort of territorial basis in Canada, is rooted in the displacement of Indigenous people, A, and B, it sort of enforces this idea that the only sort of possibility of any wealth generation is based in a very sort of individualistic or family bubble, as opposed to thinking through what could collective wealth be, or a housing reality that's not based on financialization. So maybe we could just zero in a bit more on thinking through this problematic of financialization, because I find that in a lot of mainstream reporting about the housing crisis, this is not broken down, right? Whether it's the sort of like investment firms buying up low-income housing and then slowly displacing communities, as we saw in the Herongate community in Ottawa. There's many other examples. So I'd love to hear a bit more about your reflections on the importance of sort of decoding and the importance of that, of this sort of financialization of housing and how that's really part of the crisis we're facing.
I am really interested in the work of Ricardo Trangen and his book, The Tenant Class. And in that book, he offers this really important idea, which is, you know, we really need to be critical of this concept of the housing crisis, because the word crisis suggests that this is, you know, accidental, or that the reason we're here is because it's outside of people's control. And in fact, the way that the system is organized generates massive profits for investors, for corporations, for large-scale landlords, and they benefit materially from the way the system is organized. And so displacement of communities through eviction, like in the case of Herongate, or in other situations where people's needs to have housing are prioritized as lower than the pathway to pursue maximum profits. It's really important that we think about, you know, even though the patterns of housing displacement are so horrifying and deepening every day, it can't change if the structures that we have to protect people are not able to kind of push back against this idea that housing should primarily be something that lines people's pockets. And I think that through the review panel on financialization, I was able to learn more about what the issue of financialization looks like and feels like for people. Tenants from Heron Gate provided their testimony about, you know, losing access to community that they built over years and years. And thinking about, you know, the way that the buildings that they lived in were allowed to just kind of like deteriorate in order to then be considered for demolition so that luxury units could be built on that site. And learning in doing research on this topic that this is actually like a very lucrative tactic that corporate landlords use. It's sort of a playbook across the world, not just in Canada. And so these are really powerful patterns that we need to, as people who are kind of at the bottom of the pyramid, we really need to act together in solidarity, because that's the power that we have. If it's not necessarily in dollars, it is through relationships. And I think that's through the research I've done around lived experience and community building. The thing that I hear over and over and that I feel to be true in the very core of my being is that being together in solidarity, acting in the interests of your peers because our interests are bound up together, is so incredibly important now more than ever.
There's a lot of layers to what you just shared, Alex, and thank you for pointing that out. I wanted to underline the sort of inherent critique of this idea that the housing crisis is just sort of this natural phenomenon. It's a very important point that you raised. Of course, the book The Tenant Class by Ricardo Tranjan is definitely one for those of you listening to look at, because it also particularly speaks to the housing crisis or the crisis of access to housing in the Canadian context. And there's a lot of books about this focused more on the United States. And, you know, there is the reality of the sort of policy administrative dynamics that we have to face in this particular context and how to address these things together. Thank you for sharing your points on that, Alex. Just sort of deepening this on this particular point, can you just speak a little bit about any sort of, this could be just quick reflections on the ways that the media talks about this issue, because I think that, you know, it's sort of, there's a lot of, like, let's say I would say you do see quite a lot of reporting about individual families or people and sort of a personalized narrative, which obviously is important. And then you see a sort of broad policy talk, but there isn't sort of this breakdown of how huge investment capital is profiting from displacing people. And so I just want to zero in on this a bit more. Because it's super important and you've looked into this.
Yeah, I want to bring it back to the point you raised about this kind of individualistic prioritization of home ownership on Indigenous territories and how these things are so deeply entrenched and at odds. I think that there's this real kind of dominant understanding that the sort of path in people's lives should be this aspiration to own property. And I think that a lot of responses to the housing crisis also prioritize this kind of very middle-class dream of everybody should be able to afford to own a home. And so a lot of resource goes into quote-unquote expanding the middle class or making sure that people can afford to buy a home. That really creates a lot of distance between some of these kind of like structural underpinnings of how people's housing is destabilized or undermined. And I think that there really is this way that interpersonal conflict and tension, it takes up a lot of like space in order to create these conflicts between members of a community who actually have a lot more in common than they do different, and look towards each other and away from the people who actually hold a great deal of power to determine how our lives unfold. So there are, you know, a lot of corporations that are operating the majority of rental housing across the country, and are according to research undertaken by a colleague, Sarah Bueller at the University of Saskatchewan, corporate landlords and real estate and investment trusts are responsible for the overwhelming majority of evictions, at least in the community where Sarah Bueller is working, but it's scalable to communities across the country. And so thinking about an issue as, you know, an individual landlord or an individual tenant, or kind of focusing in on how one person experiences crisis in the housing system, doesn't allow us to look at the full picture of how these things are actually patterns that reproduce themselves over time. And once we start to be able to put the pieces together to say, actually, this is a pattern, then we have a lot more power to be able to push back and create alternatives.
And, you know, it's an interesting point there that you focused on, which is alternatives and, you know, the underfunding of housing cooperatives in Canada in the mid-1990s is a clear example of the attack on actual alternatives. The Chrétien Martin governments in the 90s just decimated funding for cooperative housing, for example. So there's a long track record here of undercutting the use of public funds towards creating these alternatives. So there's, you know, this interesting moment where we're seeing a lot of tenant union organizing that addresses sort of some of the more like individual examples or even like neighborhood examples of the realities you've been talking about. But a lot of that organizing is happening with a broader analysis of combating, let's say, the broader sort of tendency towards financialization of housing and how that's interconnected with a lot of other systemic issues. People are hearing this interview either online or on community radio stations in Canada, which are also, you know, remaining infrastructure of, you know, community organizations that are alternative institutions, right? And it makes me think about the importance in this time to think about the importance of physical spaces as actual alternatives to these structures of power and economics that clearly are not benefiting the majority of people, and sort of thinking beyond this sort of distraction of a lot of the mainstream talking points. I mean, even the conservatives are talking about the housing crisis, but clearly they're not interested in building up alternatives, whether it's cooperatives or, you know, community radio or women's centers or public universities. You know, there's a lot of fueling of a recognition of a certain anger that exists today. But there's not a lot of actual addressing of what a collective public alternatives can be. And obviously that's complicated to address, but it sort of seems to be one of the questions that community organizers and activists really are in the place to start thinking through in a real way.
Yeah, I love that you connected these ideas of, you know, local radio and public spaces and spaces where people can come together, because I do think there is right now this process of defunding and sort of removing support for all of these spaces for, you know, the commons, the way that we can have third spaces or spaces where people can come together, but they don't necessarily have to be, you know, for profit. And I think, you know, I'm really moved by cooperative housing as an alternative model to the system that we currently have, and other ways that people can, you know, be in community and have housing security and take care of one another. All of these models of mutual aid and carving out space and protecting it for each other, I think, are really powerful ways that we can keep stories alive and tell the truth in a way that is really increasingly hard to do in the system that we have currently. And I think tenant unions are also really important and doing incredible organizing work to help make sure, you know, policies are pushed back against when they're going to cause harm to people's housing status, or to make sure that if there's, you know, a mass eviction, that there are ways that people are being organized in a way that, you know, is sometimes hard to do when you're facing eviction and you have all of these other things going on in your life. But to provide that energy and effort and support to make sure that, you know, you have this kind of future and space and community that can take care of you, I think it's really important. I'm doing some work with colleagues here in London to start an art hive as a way for people to come together specifically around issues of housing across the housing spectrum to create together, to do art together, and to just be in community and sit with each other, to break bread with each other. And so we're in the process of creating this space in response to this deep need to have places where people can just rest together and have access to leisure and joy, because those things are often the first things that are removed when we're facing insecurity or defunding. And so I think as a researcher, a lesson I've learned from some of my peers and colleagues is to always look to ways that we can use the resources that we have for a collective good.
That was a conversation with Alex Nelson, a researcher based in London, Ontario, Western University, speaking about the dynamics of housing precarity and the housing crisis in Canada from a collective level, looking at some of the systemic issues and interconnections between housing injustice and how that is tied to other intersecting points of injustice in Canadian society. I think this is a set of important ideas that have been shared on this broadcast. I would encourage people to look up housingjustice.now online to learn more about some interconnected housing justice movements, some of which we've featured here on this program, including a zine that I recently edited, Voices for Housing Justice. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. I host and produce the program, and we air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 90. 3.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can learn more about the program by visiting soundcloud.com/freecityradio. That's also where the archives are. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Kristoff. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.